The overwhelming concern about human health at the moment has overshadowed a number of other concerns, including environmental health, which might explain why the Trump administration has taken executive action to weaken enforcement of some environmental regulations while the economy is in free fall. That's an issue for another day. Today, we'll talk about the general range of issues facing trees in our part of the world. Daniel Matthews from Portland is the author of Trees in Trouble: Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. Daniel made a career of writing about the natural history of our part of the world. Along the way, he has backpacked extensively, lived in a forest cabin without electricity, and watched for fires from a mountain lookout, among other pursuits. Daniel Matthews, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
It seems like this book pulls together a lot of things you've learned through the years.
Yes. Bark beetles, fires, general drought problems for trees, and white pine blister rust are some of the main troubles for trees that the book covers.
Now, you do focus on pines in the book. Does science see them in more trouble than other trees, perhaps?
Well, hard to say. You know, not far from you, you've got Port Orford cedar, which is a terribly problematic tree because of an exotic disease. So no, I wouldn't say pines are necessarily in worse trouble. No, they offer a nice range of fire adaptations and a nice range of issues. So I felt that was a good way to limit the scope of the book a little bit.
And you limit it a little further by focusing primarily on dry forests in the book. Is that right? Not the wetter zones?
Right, and that's pretty much congruent with pines because up in, you know, western Washington and the wet forests of the Pacific Northwest, we hardly have pines, very few.
Usually firs and hemlocks and cedars and stuff like that?
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, Daniel, there's no single chapter on climate change in the book, and you point that out as you're getting started. Why is that?
Didn't really need to. It's just the ocean we're all swimming in.
Uh-huh. It's kind of like enough to tell a fish what water is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's an oh yeah moment in saying the forests of 2050 could be very different from the forests of a century before. Does science even really have an idea at this point how different the forests of 2050 might be from the forests of 1950?
Well, yeah, that's the science I pulled together in this book. There's a lot of evidence that some of the forests will be converting to brush fields or grassland. Typically, it'll happen after a fire. In the Klamath, there's a really interesting paper that came out a year or two ago suggesting that not only will you get back to having more fires, but in the wake of these fires, since you have plenty of rainfall there and it's not going to convert to grassland or semi-desert or anything, there's plenty of rainfall for trees to grow, but there will be a big advantage to the trees that can re-sprout. And in the climate, that means your pan oak and your madrone and your myrtle, in other words, the broadleaf evergreen. And So this paper predicts that there will be a big increase of them at the expense of conifers, especially in the wake of fires in the Klamath region.
But you're talking about the places, and you're getting a little off mic. I'm not sure what's going on that end, or if it's just a connection problem. But when you talk about places going to brush fields or grasslands, I mean, are we talking about the possibility that forests simply won't regenerate after either a catastrophe or a clear cut?
That's absolutely right. That's been going on for a while locally, and you can never quite say absolutely for sure that forests will never come back, but the calculations and the models suggest that in a lot of the places where seedlings are not really coming up, that they may never.
Okay, I got you a little off mic again. Oh, there we are. There we are. Are the changes coming faster than most of us might think?
Yes.
Truly, it's just happening that fast. I mean, even faster. Are scientists surprised? The people who know forests very well.
A couple of years ago, three, four years ago, you would have said, like, guy whose name I'm blocking on, Stevenson, who works down at Sequoia National Park, you know, he was happy that the giant sequoias were one tree that was not showing much effect yet, and now they are. Just in the last 2 years, they've started to see giant sequoias dying from, a few of them dying for drought, from drought.
Okay, that is a little scary, because that's the place where they're used to having some snow up there and things like that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they're getting it this week. That's good.
Okay, that's right. That's right. We got a little more activity over the weekend. You start the book in terms of tree species with ponderosa pines, and you remind us they're not just fire survivors. How do ponderosa pines actually help fires burn?
Oh, they drop a lot of fuel on the ground. Their cones are excellent fuel. Their needles are excellent fuel because they're really long needles. They hold up a little bit off the surface of the ground and dry out well. And because they fall in bunches of three, they tend to catch on shrubbery. They have a great word for this, needles rape. When you see the dried ponderosa pine or Jeffrey pine needles hanging up all over the shrubs, that's needle drape, and it's terrific kindling. So you get these flashy, fast, hot fires at the ground level with the needles and the cones. Then you have a thick bark on the trees so that they can survive a low, fast, hot fire like that.
All right, but again, those fires on the forest floor and not the kind that we're used to seeing in that go up the tree or get into the canopy of the forest. That's a whole different sort of thing. We'll discuss this and more with Daniel Matthews, the author of Trees in Trouble, Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10.
All right.
Pretty good writing technique in here, Daniel. Will you tell us about a forest guru and refer to him by that appellation for a while until you reveal that it's Jerry Franklin? For the people who never heard the name, can you give the starter sketch?
Well, he became well known in the 70s and 80s during the days of the wars over ancient forests and over bringing a halt to logging of the most mature and, you know, untouched forests. And he was a scientist working in the H.J. Andrews Research Forest in the Oregon Cascades. And the place, the research forest, had basically been set up as a way to research how best to clear-cut trees and grow new ones in their place. It was entirely a facet of the timber industry. But work there, he and his colleagues began to see that there was so much going on in an old growth forest that would not happen in a young second growth forest, and then this ecology was important to the long-term health of forests. And so basically our familiarity with the word old growth actually stems from their discoveries, and they're promoting that word. Then after some years working there, he got more interested in what he called the dry forests, which are the ones dominated by ponderosa pine traditionally, or at least with some ponderosa pine in them, because their fire ecology is so different, because they are adapted to have these low surface fires and to survive them and to benefit from them by taking care of all the competition.
And he had some fairly harsh opposition to his findings, at least at first, and not just from the timber industry. Why do some environmentalists have issues with Jerry Franklin's work?
Well, it kind of stems partly from his moving over and seeing the dry forests as very different from the wet forests, and seeing that they need to be thinner and that this could benefit from some logging. Also, I would say that, you know, since he went to forestry school in the first place, seeing it as related to the timber industry, he always had some sympathy with the idea that forests do provide wood products, and that to see a balance between preserving a lot of the best of the old growth and allowing some to be used in the most sustainable possible fashion for timber industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
industry was not really operating at a sustainable level before those days.
Because they were cutting trees faster than they could grow back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at this point, some of the stuff that Jerry Franklin has talked about is kind of in the well-does zone, that you need to restore natural forest conditions. But as we talked about earlier, what is natural is changing rapidly. I mean, is it hard for scientists and silviculturalists and all those people to figure out what the baselines are? I mean, what the normal processes in any forest ecosystem should be, particularly with the should changing?
That's true. They use the term historic range of variability, trying to figure out what the forests were like when the first white settlers arrived. And the dry forests were thinner then. They had a higher proportion of ponderosa pine. The trees were bigger and fewer. They were pretty sparse. Some of those forests might get described as a meadow with scattered trees. But in the most recent years, Jerry and a lot of others are saying we really don't even want to talk about historic range of variability anymore because those days were part of the Little Ice Age, which was quite a bit cooler and wetter than today, and much cooler and wetter than the century that our present small trees are going to live in, we hope. So they're trying to figure out the future range of variability, and it is difficult.
Huh, because the past is not a good guide anymore.
Not as good. It can help, but it's not the template for where we need to go.
Daniel Matthews, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Trees in Trouble, Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. Let's move into fire and the section of the book on that, because give the contrast what a pine forest looks like years after low-intensity fire versus what you've seen when you walked into places where there were fires, high-intensity fires in a pine forest.
Oh, well, the trouble in the high-intensity fires and why they lead to deforestation sometimes is when the high severity, and I should clarify here that the severity is a measure of the amount of change in the vegetative community or the amount of mortality of trees specifically, whereas intensity is more the physics of the fire, exactly how hot is it and how high up the trunks does it go. So they're kind of correlated, but they're different words.
Okay, I appreciate you separating those out. Severity versus intensity, okay.
Yeah, high severity patches where nearly all the canopy trees are dead are getting bigger. And that is the most troubling trend about recent fires, because when the high severity patches are huge, it's hard for seeds of trees to reach the centers of those patches. It can take a very long time in nature. And if they don't, then brush may take over. And in parts of the world like where you are in California, the brush is often very dense and very flammable chaparral. So that can be a whole other alternative steady state for the ecology.
So you run through a couple of examples where things have burned over with high severity fire and the vegetation has changed. It's become chaparral or grassland or just brush fields.
Or just weeds.
Mm-hmm, right.
In like worst fires down in the Southwest, it's mostly just, it's not even much brush yet. It's just scrubby weeds.
Well, there's a particular focus in the book, in the fire section, about the forests of the Klamath Mountains, you know, right in the middle of our region. What are they converting to after fire?
Well, that's chaparral is one thing. There's some big patches of chaparral. Mm-hmm. Some of them are growing back reasonably well. I mean, like a high proportion of the Biscuit Fire area was doing fairly well. I mean, portions of it were not, but portions had conifers growing back, at least until the Jetco Bar fire came along. So that's another problem, is when the fires, severe fires, recur too frequently. Where was I? Right. That they're seeing a trend toward more of the broadleaf evergreen trees dominating the vegetation in the future there in the Klamath.
All right. Switching over from Madrone. Okay, I see Madrone and manzanita, stuff like that. So the things that are green all year, but not conifers, not the needles.
Right.
Yeah, got it. Not less fire, but more fire is called for. We've talked about this quite a bit all across JPR News for years now. It's a huge project, it seems, to prepare forests for more regular fires, given all the years of fire suppression.
Yes, and for a lot of these forests, it would be ideal to do some thinning. Gives the trees that you leave a better chance of surviving when a fire does come along. Ideally, thinning followed by a prescribed fire within a few years. There's so much area that needs to be treated that there isn't likely to be a budget for that much thinning and prescribed fire. So we're seeing a fair amount of evidence, at least locally, that if fires are allowed to burn, it's at relatively benign times of year, like early summer before things have dried out horribly, or just when it isn't a heat wave or a really windy time, that those fires may be fairly beneficial and may take care of fuel treatment and reduce the trend toward bigger high-severity patches, which is what we're worried about.
Daniel Matthews is an author from Portland who has been writing for a long time about the natural history of the American West. His latest book is called Trees in Trouble, Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, something really meaty for our part of the region to talk about. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move from fire to outbreak, because we're getting into disease and infestation. And what kinds of trends are we seeing here?
Well, drought makes trees more vulnerable to bark beetles. And so that's a big part of why they have been increasing. Also, farther north, the invasion of bark beetles into central British Columbia and also at the higher elevations like at Yellowstone has to do with warming, because it allows the insects to breed faster and to survive more winters. So that, of course, was a terrible thing across California in 2014, 2015, 2016, toward the end of it, their terrible 4-year drought.
Mm-hmm. And now, one of the things I didn't realize, Daniel, is how hardy mountain pine beetles are. I mean, what are some of the things they do to survive harsh conditions?
Well, they overwinter as larvae under the bark, and their body chemistry changes, and they create alcohols. And as you may know from freezing bottles of vodka, alcohol lowers the freezing temperature of a liquid, so it enables the larvae to make it through very cold winters without freezing and dying.
Interesting. It's usually bottles of gin in my case, but yeah, I get the reference that you can stick it in the freezer and it'll still be liquid, a thicker liquid perhaps, but mm-hmm. still. So is there the same degree of difficulty in restoring a forest that has been laid waste by bugs or disease as there is in restoring a forest with a high-severity fire?
Well, it's probably somewhat easier. I mean, you have a cohort of trees that survive and are going to suddenly be growing much faster because they're getting more sun and more of the water, less competition. So some of the beetle-killed forests, a lot of them look just horrible for a year or two and then look surprisingly green just three or four years later because the surviving trees are growing fast and leafing out more. It may change the species proportion within the tree because bark beetles are always attacking some of the species and not others. Usually, though, I don't know, in the Sierra Nevada and in California in recent years, as soon as the pines were attacked a couple years later, the beetles seemed to be getting worse on the white firs and incense cedars, which had been survivors of the first bad years. So most of the trees do have a bark beetle. But now, their epidemics happen at different times.
Mm-hmm. There's a good point that you raise in here, which is to ask the question about whether drought actually kills forests directly or whether it just weakens trees for other things to come along and kill them.
Mm-hmm. Mostly it weakens, but it can kill them directly.
Mm-hmm. Just for lack of water. Let us take a phone call here. Bill in Sutherland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking trees in trouble with Daniel Matthews. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Not bad. If you drive I-5 between Roseburg and Sutherland, right along by, what's the little town there? I can't think of it. Anyway.
Winchester?
Canyonville?
North of there.
Okay.
Between Roseburg and Sutherland on I-5.
That's Winchester, isn't it?
If you look on the west side...
Mm-hmm.
That whole hillside there, it's mixed madrone and Douglas fir, and all those fir are dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some fir on my property that are dying too. I wonder, you know, with the extensive clear cutting that we're doing in the Coast Range, for instance, because most of that's private property, mm-hmm. or a lot of it is, that we could be changing the climate by cutting all these trees down. Because if you look at the Amazon basin,
mm-hmm.
when I flew over the Amazon in Peru in 1964, that was, you couldn't see the hand of man anywhere. I can't even imagine what it looks like now. But they say that that forest actually creates rain.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about that independence. Bill, thanks for that point. Thanks for the phone call. And Daniel, take it away.
Yeah, forests in the Northwest, if they create rain, it's probably farther east because they water transpires out of their needles. But they also do make it wetter here because of fog drip. They intercept fog blowing over through the mountain ridges, and then that those drips fall to earth, and it makes a substantial difference in the amount of water from the clouds input into the ecosystem. And it certainly is a concern about the Amazon that the entire Amazon basin could tend more towards savanna 50 years from now because crossing a tipping point through cutting so many trees that they aren't recycling as much water to keep falling as rain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've changed the ecosystem completely in those cases. I want to bring in a couple of names here before we get to a break. Connie Millar and Diana Six, what did they figure out about forest dieback and some potential advantages there?
Well, it's interesting, and it's not very well proven yet, but there has been at least one paper since I finished my manuscript supporting their hypothesis that, it's clear that when bark beetles go through a pine forest and they kill 80% of the trees of a given species, that that the ones that are surviving must have some difference genetically that enables them to survive the bark beetle. Connie Millar came up with a hypothesis that the traits that make some trees able to survive the bark beetle attack that's killing all of their conspecifics will also make them better adapted to warmer climates. She found, at least within one species, in one area, that looking back at the tree rings over the last 150 years, that the survivors were trees that had grown relatively slowly during wet times, but relatively well during dry times compared to the trees that were killed. So that needs more work, but it would be a really interesting possibility.
All right. We'll come back and talk more with Daniel Matthews. Our apologies for the phone connection. Not quite sure what's happening there, but he does kind of come and go. We're compensating on our end as best we can. His book is Trees in Trouble, Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. We'll be back with Daniel and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Before we leave the idea of outbreak, infestations of pathogens and beetles, we have a question from Larry, no town given, who says, what is the role of the decline of birds and small mammals in tree health and population of bark beetles? That again from Larry.
Well, I don't think there's very much of a direct connection to bark beetles. Certainly there are birds especially that come in and eat the bark beetles once an infestation is underway. But the scientists I've talked to don't believe that that's a really significant way to control an epidemic of bark beetles, unfortunately. The bird populations just cannot increase or move into the area fast enough to have a major impact. Small mammals, I don't think, eat bark beetles much at all.
All right. So there's a whole chapter called Cookie Cutters in here about homogeneity in forests. You take us back to your old lookout at Desolation Peak. Where is that and what happened to the forest there?
Desolation Peak is almost at the Canadian border in Washington in the North Cascades. It's an amazing place. You can hardly see any artificial light at all from up there except the general glow of Vancouver and the general glow of Seattle on the horizon at night. But it's way off in the wilderness. And it was named Desolation because it was swept by a fire back in the 1920s, I think, but it's actually not a particularly desolate place now. It's just beautiful and has trees and meadows and blueberries and amazing views. And it was made famous by Jack Kerouac, who spent one summer there at Fire Lookout and wrote a book called Desolation Angel based on his journal from when he was there.
And so what is it?
The chapter is called Cookie Cutters in reference to cookies being these round pieces of wood cut out from trees for tree ring studies. So I was referring to tree ring scientists as cookie cutters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a call here because I think this is germane to the subject we're talking about now. Pam and Dexter, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Matthews, the author of Trees in Trouble.
Hi. Well, this is a subject near and dear to my heart. I know a few years ago in Lane County, they were planting ponderosa pines, kind of planning for a hotter, drier climate in lieu of the Douglas firs, not necessarily for logging and for wood products, but just to have trees growing still. And then I had read about a study a few years ago that was about the mature, old-growth trees kind of helping distressed younger trees and sending through the mycelium nutrients, and it was really fascinating, and it kind of confirmed what I've already known from other studies, is that the forest, a natural forest, is so much more healthy and resilient than a tree plantation, single age, single crop, single monoculture crop of what the private lands are doing just for logging, and that the soil is super important to keep it intact, and any disturbance of the forest floor will break up that mycelium and release, like, I guess, over 40% of the carbon that's stored in the forest floor. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the difference and the importance of maintaining our natural forest opposed to the monocrop tree plantations that we have on private lands for health and to be more resilient as our climate gets drier and hotter. And I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Thank you, Pam.
Okay, well, you covered it pretty well there. And the almost all plants, 90% of plants, and certainly all the conifers in the West, have mycorrhizal relationships with fungi, where they're exchanging nutrients. The carbohydrates from the plants go into the fungi, and the fungi help collect water and phosphorus and other nutrients from the soil. And then the discovery which the caller was referring to was that not only are the fungi pulling things from the soil, but they're pulling useful nutrients from other plants and then distributing them to other plants, even unrelated species. So in this way, the mature trees are able to help the young trees get started. I wouldn't say they're necessarily doing it on purpose, but that's the effect you end up with. When a forest goes on undisturbed for centuries, or no, I shouldn't say undisturbed for centuries, because their disturbances do come through, but if it's left to do its own thing as opposed to being clear-cut, then things are you have greater complexity, more species of mycorrhizal fungi, and more carbon in the soil, and more nitrogen. In Northwest forests, a major source of nitrogen is certain types of lichens that grow high up in the trees and fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere. And then when they crumble, or when even just water flowing over them will leach a little of that nitrogen, which is usable nitrogen, not like what's in the air as NO2, but it's plant usable nitrogen, gets cycled into the plant system, which is great. But those particular lichens that do that do not become numerous until the trees are mature, like 80 or 100-year-old Douglas firs. So that's another important thing about the ecology of old-growth forests that you don't get in young plantations.
Now, the chapter on cookie cutters, called Cookie Cutters, gets into dendrochronology, using the tree cores to backdate events in history, which I was reading about separately recently, about bristlecone pines in particular, and the ability to pinpoint certain climate cycles. You compare a bunch of trees that have the same kinds of rings, you can say, well, this is what happened in the climate at that time. Is there any record similar to what's happening in the climate now from these tree cores?
Well, it's hard. I'm not sure if tree cores are great at showing when were the periods that were warmer or drier, or colder or wetter, or colder or warmer. Sorry. But they wouldn't necessarily give you an absolute measurement of how cold it was. So, there's been debate over whether the Holocene climatic optimum around 5,000 years ago was warmer than today or not. It probably was not quite, but the best records of that have more to do directly with chemistry, chemistry which is found in ice cores in Greenland, and then actually at Oregon Caves near you, some of the best speleothem records, which are thin layers in stalactites in caves, also show the ratio of oxygen isotopes. And by microscopically measuring the ratio of different isotopes in oxygen, that's a pretty good proxy for climate, for temperature.
Ah, okay. So there are other ways to check, and some argument about the trees, it sounds like, about whether they're good.
But the trees could do a great job of telling you exactly which year was a wetter year or a drier year, even 850 years ago or even 2,000 years ago if it's a bristlecone.
Yeah, which is amazing with the bristlecones. Some of them living past 4,000 years and able to take core samples out, leave the tree alive, and get a good record. It's amazing stuff. Let's take another phone call here. Mark in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Matthews, the author of Trees in Trouble.
Good morning, Daniel. I'm from back east, from Connecticut, and I moved out here, and I'm now sharing a home with someone. We live on a five-acre plot in Josephine County at the very top of a hill. And we've got a mixed bag. We've got lots of oaks, and we've got some madrone, and we've got several different kinds we've got a couple different kinds of fir and a lot of Douglas fir. And I've noticed lately that one of the kinds of pines that we have has been infested with beetles, and I think it's because the property abutting us has been, they've been taking some bulldozers up, and now they're going to put a new home up there, I think. And I'm worried about the idea that if those beetles are stressed, we're going to get more of them, and then I want to be able to take care of them so they don't spread any further, but I don't know. I'm thinking I'm going to have to call an arborist, a certified arborist or something like that.
All right. Let's see if we've got some advice here. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. If your pines are all infested, heavily infested with beetles, they may be doomed. And you're right that an arborist could tell you and would probably recommend taking them out. Sorry to say. The ones, not necessarily every pine, but every one that's heavily infested. But those beetles are different species than the ones that attack Douglas fir, so you don't have to worry about them making that move, at least.
Yeah, we have a couple of different kinds of critters and trees in the area he's talking about, including the flathead wood borer was causing some issues, has been for a few years now. I wanted to ask about the effects of invasive species on pine forests. How big an issue is that, Daniel?
Maybe the biggest issue that touched on things I wrote about in my book was cheatgrass as a carrier of fire, but that wouldn't be in Western Oregon much. We get a little bit of cheatgrass, but cheatgrass is especially threatening sagebrush systems and getting into pinyon pine in the Great Basin states. But we don't much have major invasions of invasive plants. Now, some of the pathogens that are a serious concern are, in a way, they're invasive species, mm-hmm. like white pine blister rust in the white pines and the Port Orford cedar blight and the Phytophthora, the sudden oak death in the tan oaks. Those are all invasive species of fungi and Oomycetes.
Oh, that's right. You remind me that there have been all sorts of efforts to restrict the kinds of stuff that gets taken in on trucks into the areas where the Port Orford cedar are, so they don't take the that version of Phytophthora in there.
Right.
I wanted to ask... go ahead.
That Phytophthora just moved downhill, so in water. So if you stop the trucks from going up to the higher elevation stands of Port Orford cedars, the stands that have survived so far might well survive for a long time.
Now, there's a fair amount of examination of fires we mentioned earlier in the book, including some discussion of the Carr fire and the Fire-Nado. You get hotter fires and a climate no longer conducive to regenerating the forest type. Understanding fires themselves certainly help. You talked to, as we have in the past, Craig Clements in the fire lab at San Jose State. They understand fire better over time, but you point out, too, they're fairly consistent threats to his research financially.
Well, since I wrote that, he's doing better. He does have his additional truck with the scanning LIDAR, I think it's called, mm-hmm. that he was hoping for, and he's thrilled with that. So I guess that was just a temporary lapse in the funding. Mm-hmm. But since you brought up fire, one thing I hoped to get into this talk today was just very recent news is the effect of COVID-19. It's going to have quite an effect on fires this summer, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out because there's just innumerable ways in which the COVID-19 is going to make firefighting much harder. Fire camps are just a hotbed for contagion, and most summers, lots of the firefighters are fighting with colds, which they've all caught from each other and are compounded with their having to breathe smoke, which causes stress on the lungs, which makes you more vulnerable to COVID-19. So firefighters are going to be at considerable risk from the pandemic. Also, we probably won't get the visiting firefighters from Australia and New Zealand, which we get when a fire year gets bad most years, recent years.
Wow, excellent points to bring in. I appreciate those. So COVID-19, obviously a big effect on firefighters potentially this summer. Daniel Matthews lives in Portland. His book is Trees in Trouble, Wildfires, Infestations, and Climate Change. Daniel, thank you so much. That's it for today's exchange. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Take care. Have a great day.